You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to this edition of Off Script, the first of 2015.
Happy New Year.
True?
Yeah, it is.
Happy New Year. I'm still recovering from the holidays. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent, Senior Editor of American Theater. I'm here with
Eliza Bent, also a senior editor.
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And this is Festival January. This is a time when there are ever-growing, it seems, group of festivals in New York. They started because
we counted earlier today that a new festival is born every half hour.
Really? Yeah, that seems about right. It's because the APAP, or the Association of Performing Arts Presenters, has a conference here, then. And these festivals have grown up, and every year we try to find a different way to write about them. Last year, we had a wonderful guide by the writer Helen Shaw, and we did a podcast about it. This year, we had a piece by Eliza, where you talked to Vallejo.
I interviewed Vallejo Gantner of PS122's Coil Festival.
You check that out.
In the past, we've done profiles of Mark Russell, and we've profiled Mei Yin Wang of the Under the Radar Festival. We really need to cover American Realness, I think, next year. They're due.
And but Prototype. Every year
what's that?
And Prototype, the Opera Theater Festival.
We're never sure how to talk about all these festivals.
So we ran through them, basically. We did do a piece about Prototype-like opera in our off-season in last April. But so that's all the festivals there. There's Coil, Under the Radar, American Realness. What was the other one?
Prototype.
But then there's also Special Effects Festival, which is now in its second year. And then something called Squirts at La Mama.
Yeah, it's like this new LGBT-themed works festival. And you should not Google that, though, by itself.
Don't Google Squirts Festival?
Don't do that by itself. Do Squirts La Mama if you're going to Google that.
So we're setting up, really, we did an interview this year for a podcast with Helen Shaw, again, festival expert, and curator herself. She's curated some festivals herself. And Alexis Solosky, formerly of The Village Voice, and now of The New York Times and The Guardian. And Eliza, tell us a little bit about this conversation.
It was a thrilling conversation. We talked a lot about theater.
Yeah.
among other things. No, we talked about sort of the little bit of the history of why these festivals have sprouted up in such abundance. Sort of like the feeling and vibe and energy of each of these festivals. I like to think about it in terms of clothing, like which store kind of clothing fits with each festival. You could do it maybe with food or music too, but we were talking about it in terms of clothing. And then we talked a lot about just what they had seen thus far this year, how it kind of compared / was in conversation with previous years, and different themes that have kind of come up for them in their various viewings. Yeah.
Is the Festival January something that either of you have participated in as a theater goer? Do you say, oh wow, January, I get to do nothing but see theater for a month?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's kind of like Christmas when it comes to for downtown experimental theater, because it's just this giant cornucopia of things that you wouldn't normally otherwise see during this year, like all packed and condensed into one two week period. And for me most of the year is straight plays, with the occasional foray into Brooklyn or interactive work. And so just like having like this binge of theater is always really fun.
It's a nice way to start the year. One thing that I sort of, when I talk about this time of year to friends who aren't involved in theater or are less involved in theater than I am, I kind of explain it as like the South by Southwest of theater in New York, or like the Freeze Art Fair, the Armory Art Showing, the Art Basel Miami, like something on this level of like massive,
right?
Massiveness.
No, that's helpful. I feel like, because people will compare these things to like Sundance or whatever, but that's really one festival that's spawned these other little ones. But I think that's probably the analogy to like South by Southwest, which has gotten so huge. It's one festival that's spawned a million, you know, and so many people go to it, and it's hard to keep track of it. I mean, maybe that's
having never been to South by Southwest.
No, me neither. But that's
love
my
to
sense
make of, comparisons to
that's
things
my sense of it. That's
I'm not intimately acquainted with
the South by Southwest of experimental.
Yeah, like that it's a big deal. That it's like a time when a lot of people, and it's not just what's great about. I find what's great about winter festival season is that it's not just New York theater makers, but it's people from other parts of the world that are. That happened to be in New York, and so you maybe get to see somebody that you met last year, or you get to see people from friends from across the country. I had got to meet up with a friend from Texas who was in town just because there's so much stuff going on, and so.
And it's also like a time of I realize this. It's a time of. It's like experimental in that all of the labels don't matter. It could be theater, it could be dance theater, it could be opera theater, it could be art installation. It's like a mishmash of things that you don't really have a label.
The genres go out the window, and it's just.
So I have to say,
it's very refreshing, I think.
I have to confess. I mean, Deep, you had a good piece about a couple durational pieces this year. That seems to be a mini trend with the Taylor Max piece and Temporary Distortions piece. For me, the entire idea of festival season sounds like durational theater. Like, just not that it's bad, but just that the time commitment and the planning involved, I just have to plead fatherhood as I do for most of my my theater going. I could see about a show a week. And for me, it seems like to dip into the festivals and see one or two shows, it would be so hard to pick which ones they would be. The only way to do it would be to immerse yourself. And I just can't immerse myself in anything that involved at this point. That's my excuse. I'm sticking to it. Why don't we go to the interview now and hear what Eliza and Helen and Alexis had to say.
Hello, listeners. We're here with Helen Shaw and Alexis Olosky, two of New York's best and brightest journalists. I'm Eliza Bent.
Hi, I'm Helen.
Hi, I'm Alexis.
Hey, we're so glad to have you. So we're talking about winter festival season here that happening in New York, and there's a lot of festivals.
There are, Eliza. There are several. In fact, before this very taping, we were learning about new festivals here on the fly.
New festivals were cropping up. Circus Now.
I think during the time, the half hour that we tape this podcast, there will probably be two or three new festivals.
Two or three festivals will be born every 4 minutes.
I can't keep up anymore. So 11 years ago, Under the Radar starts. Before Under the Radar, January is basically dead. And you know what? I don't think anyone minded. I think it was kind of nice. Restful, cold. So Under the Radar starts, Coil starts the next year, and then we get American Realness, and then suddenly, like, the floodgates open. And now it's more festivals than we can count. So Prototype I was aware of. And right, just before we started, we were talking about festivals I haven't even heard of, like special effects that I never even saw a listing for. Circus Now that I know only tangentially squirts at La Mama, which is a festival that, it's quite a name.
Yes, true.
I was, you know, talking to a friend the other night who is not a theater person but had come to see a show. And I was out afterwards, and he was saying, wait, there's festivals happening now? And as a non-theater person, I was particularly charmed, and then I was trying to explain to him what each of these festivals were. And so I was comparing Under the Radar to kind of like the Gap or the Banana Republic of festivals, and then American Realness would maybe be American Apparel. Coil possibly would be Topshop. I don't know. I wonder if you could talk about each of these. What is like the spirit of each of these festivals?
I guess, I don't know. I feel like maybe Under the Radar is more like J. Crew, and that like it has things that I would actually want to wear as opposed to the Gap and Banana Republic.
An imperfect analogy, I admit. Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, it's definitely, it's the granddaddy of them. It's Mark Russell, who for a very long time was the artistic director at PS122, now joined by Mei and Wang. And some years it does seem like we're seeing a lot of the same names, and he does bring back people, which I don't think most audiences have a problem with. But I like that it's still weird. I like that every year when I get the release for it, there are definitely a bunch of names on there that I haven't heard of. And this year, since they're starting a works in development series, there are a lot of names I haven't heard of.
Well, and I think also they, since they have the kind of the privilege of a little bit of money, and also the sort of longevity of their festival means that they have international relationships that the other theaters sort of, I think, maybe struggle a little bit more to maintain. So COIL, which is PS122's festival, always does have something international in it, which is always thrilling, but it's usually something that's necessarily sort of small in scale. And I think, therefore, if you're kind of looking for what's the hot new Brazilian you know, show with 10 people in it, you've only got one option, which is to go to the public. And it's true, there are many of the same names coming back, but I have to say they have a pretty good record for keeping around the good ones. So Mariana Pansati, who's here this year, was one of the great, great breakouts of last year, and the show this year is equally strong. So I think it's, yeah, I would say if I were a person building a schedule, I tend to use Under the Radar schedule as kind of my armature, and then work around that.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And of course, the other great, great advantage that Under the Radar has is the public theater itself, because it didn't start off in the public theater, of course. It was just sort of ambient and floating, but then it came there after a couple of years, and it's a space with five or six spaces in it. And of course, they partner with other venues, La Mama most particularly. But when you're there during the festival, it actually feels like a festival, that there are people milling in the lobby and in the mezzanine, and there's kind of an air of excitement there, which is something that the other spaces don't have, because of course PS122's building is under construction right now, so they're spread out all over, and American Realness just doesn't have as many things happening simultaneously. Prototype is again spread out all over the city. So it's an Under the Radar where you really have the most sense of a festival.
I will say, when you're saying that American Realness is like the American Apparel, it's so true. Down to the fact that I would be willing to bet that American Apparel onesies are on 30% of the American Realness stages. It is the hip place to be. And an artist who shall not be named, who was in American Realness 2 years ago, I saw her coming out of it, and she was saying, it's always high school. We're still in high school, and these are the cool kids. So it is American Realness, I think, if your interest is in stuff that is maybe a little prickly and a little aggressive on an aesthetic front, I think you won't find that at Under the Radar. You're going to find weird but accessible. Whereas if you really want to have, if you are desperate to watch someone wearing a bear suit doing a tribute to the Rite of Spring, you really have to get over to Abrams.
And of course, there's a big emphasis on dance, which the other festivals don't have as much. Although COIL does do a fair amount of dance, but American Realness, I would say, is more dance than anything else. Although, as you said earlier, the dance does have a really strong performance, theatrical component, most of it. But
so I had a question for Eliza, actually, if I may turn the tables.
And I
journalist.
Would just like to briefly point out that American Apparel does specialize in leotards.
That's
so
true.
Kind of is a perfect.
There is.
That's a pretty. That's a
if
good analogy.
Looking, if they're looking for some sort of brand, major brand relationship.
Prototype would obviously be Ann Taylor or some sort of.
Oh, that's so mean.
No, they're very polished.
Who likes Ann Taylor?
Up to date on the contemporary opera. But Helen, your question
is. Ms. Bent, you also have been to many, many a fest. And not this year, perhaps you're a touch busy this year, but in the past, what have been the festivals that you sought out first?
Well, I think what you said about having Under the Radar as kind of like an overarching principle or guide framework to kind of think about your programming around, certainly I agree. I think it's always such a hard time of year. It's so hard to choose in some senses. And this year, I am busy, as you said. And so I sort of am a little bit more resigned this year to sort of seeing only what I'm either like dragged to or have many, many, many friends in. And so I feel like kind of peaceful about only seeing a few things this year. And really, I only can see a few things this year, given what my schedule is at the moment. But it's that funny thing of like, it's festival time and it's fun to see things that you think are going to be a good bet and that you're going to like. But then it's always nice to branch out and see something that you have no idea about, that you read the description and just sounds like it could be interesting or cool. So it's sort of like an intuitive thing, I guess, for me. But getting back to both of you and the things that you have seen, what has stood out in particular this year or surprised you or things, trends, themes?
Well, there's definitely, I think that using audience as a set piece, using audience as part of your set, has been something that has been growing and growing in, I don't even know what you would call this, the kind of like intersection between live arts and theater maybe, or the experimental theater zone. We know these people are not in the festival this year, but I know that all of us have seen 600 Highwaymen, who use audience often as kind of almost one of their design elements. And this year there are
Gob Squad, of course.
Gob Squad, exactly.
So I think it's here before relational aesthetics.
Right. So it's theater the that eats the audience is kind of, I think, a big theme. And so for one of my favorite shows this year was the very first show I saw, which was Phaedra Skull's Thank You for Coming. And it is a good show.
Thanks, Faye, for making.
And it is, that one I think actually has a few more shows. So you could still head over to Dance Space and just stand in the doorway and cry. I've noticed that a lot of people have been using tears to get in when the wait list is long. So feel free to just look innocent and pained. I think that's been a real winner for people already. And then also...
Wait. Tell me why it's so great.
So,
and I want to also get to relational aesthetics when we
delve
into
who doesn't,
right?
Who doesn't?
Right. If we haven't quoted Rancière by the end of this podcast, we're all fired. So, the Faye Driscoll, choreographer interested in theater, who has made a piece. It's sort of a triptych about how a company can snare an audience. So the first section, and a lot of it is based in surprise and sort of coup de théâtre, so you don't want to tell too much. But the beginning is very, very naive, very sweet. The dancers sing the "Put away your cell phone" announcement. They stand up in the balcony of Dance Space and sing this adorable song about how please make sure no one can reach you. And then they come down and they do a piece which is it seems very much in the kind of center of what modern dance looks like, which is making the awkwardness apparent. So they like tie themselves into knots. They can't, the knot cannot sustain. Only the fact that they're hanging onto each other's hands means that they can even stay upright. They sometimes have to grab out and hold the audience's hands just to keep the tension. And
the audience is very close.
They're wrapped around this sort of tiny raft
almost of dancers. Yeah. And you can see their tendons and their hair and their sweat.
Yeah. And their eye rolls, you know, like after if one dancer decides to brace his foot on another dancer's cheek, you know, you can see her kind of getting a little huffy. And then basically it kind of explodes from there, so that by the end, in much the same way that Ghost Quartet does with music, it basically turns itself inside out. So by the end, the audience is performing and the dancers have vanished.
Now, Helen, I know you well, and I know that you hate audience participation.
I do.
When you are called upon to do it.
I'm an Episcopalian, and we don't participate, you know? We really... I have perfected a sort of an icy shell that I use in shows when it looks like I might need to perform. And
like that Living Theater show years
ago? Oh, yeah, yeah.
In which I did not have an icy shell and basically got groped for
half
an hour.
That's true. That's true. I hid behind the guy who was filming and pretended that I was with him, and that kept me safe. But
what?
Yeah. Never go to a show. Yeah. We were both at this, what was it called?
Red something. It was like Mickey Spillane and Nuclear War. And then they like drag you up and make you perform.
It was a lot of contact improv, which for
really,
the
really,
out there,
really touchy. Like my cast party of hair in high school contact improv.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Sober.
Sober Contact Improv is nobody's friend. And so I saw Alexis basically getting passed hand over hand like we were in a mosh pit. And so I was at that point hunkered down, and I do not exaggerate, hunkered down behind the cameraman so they couldn't get to me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, I got out of the theater and I actually like kind of like collapsed a little bit. Like onto my knees, and then I dialed my editor and I said, "Do you hate me? Why?
Oh,
why?
No.
Why did you?"
So, Helen, what do you do in an example like "Thank you for coming"? Where
so
there is
that's why I'm so interested.
But I wouldn't say that it's.
Oh no, I didn't hunker down.
Gropey.
So Faye's piece is basically it just has a lot of outs. So if you really don't want to wear the shower cap, you know, you don't have to wear the shower cap. And if you don't want to do anything dancey, you can either get yourself off in a corner or it's not a pushy performance.
Okay. So there are ways to escape.
Participation thing.
Gentle.
Exactly. Yeah. This is not Dionysus in 69 where you sign a release before you go in. You know, like it's totally like you have options. So anyway, but I thought it was incredibly charming. And I think it's kind of the hit of the like college circuit, which I understand. But I think... I think it's much more sophisticated than the show that Alexis is talking about. Like it was, anyway. So that I was very charmed by that. What are
and
your
this
favorites,
business
Ben?
About the relational aesthetics.
Relational aesthetics, yeah. So relational aesthetics is sort of it's like the art world discovered theater a few years ago, prompted by a book called Relational Aesthetics by, as Helen has said, Rancière. Jean Paul? I can't remember his first name.
It's French.
Yeah, it's definitely French. And the idea is that certain kinds of performance or art making depend not only on the performance itself, but on the participation in some ways with the audience. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean full-on audience participation as we're characterizing it, but the way that the presence of spectators changes the piece. And we've all seen theater where it wouldn't matter who was in the house that night and what they were doing. And, you know, both on Broadway and way, way off. And then there are plays that seem uniquely sensitive to the presence of the spectator and the interaction and interventions between the performers and the spectators creates and forms the piece in some way, that the piece is not fully formed or achieved until you have both the spectatorial presence and sometimes the spectatorial action involved in it.
And so there's a lot of, you know, I would say Faye's piece is the most sort of exaggerated of those. I'm sort of scrolling through the things I saw. But, for instance, Ike at Night, which I would recommend to any human, because it is, again, just beyond adorable. I don't mean adorable to in any way minimize the comic
I mean,
talent.
He is adorable.
He is adorable. He is straight adorable.
Yeah.
And
but not in a belittling way.
No, no.
At all.
God, no. God, no. Awesome and adorable, let us say. Like a giant teddy bear. And he does, this is a show that's at, it's Late Night at the Public, and it is, it's produced by Jack, which is the theater run by Mr. Duffy. And it is a pretend, except I was going to say it's a pretend talk show, except that in every way that matters, it is actually a functioning talk show. But if we were not there, it wouldn't look like Late Night. It wouldn't look like Late Night if we weren't sitting there obeying the applause sign. And it is both simultaneously making fun of it, but enormously affectionate because it is very functional. I mean, I actually heard from the man who is the congressional representative from Fort Greene. I heard from, you know,
they have guests.
They actually have real guests. They're real guests. And they're actually the kind of guests that you wish Fallon had if he, you know, cared about, you know, social justice in Bushwick as opposed to the Golden Globes. So that's another one where I think it's sort of playing with the idea of the fact that we sit down and watch this sort of stuff. And if we weren't watchers, if we weren't experienced watchers, we wouldn't be so in on the joke.
So I have to say I've had a more disappointing festival so far, although I haven't seen that much.
Alexis, why?
Yeah. Well,
really?
You know, the best thing I saw will not be news to regular theatergoers in that it was the Daniel Fish show based on David Foster Wallace's text, mm-hmm. a radically condensed and expanded, supposedly fun thing I'll never do again, which was originally seen at the Chocolate Factory a couple of years ago, although it was much longer then. It was almost 3 hours then. It's 90 minutes now. And I have to say, I have no problem with the 90-minute version. But
I went back and read my review of the first one, and literally the first paragraph of that review is about the fact that you have to go to the bathroom first. I was like, wow, I guess I was really fixating in the 2.5-hour intermissionless version on bathroom breaks.
90 minutes feels great, and...
Does that feel at all untrue to David Foster Wallace?
You know,
I wonder. I mean,
so David Foster Wallace did write long pieces, but you know, he did write some shorter ones. He wrote shorter essays for magazines. But what I really like about it, which again will be familiar if you've seen it before, is as in, let's say, Nature Theater of Oklahoma, the cast are equipped with MP3 players, and so they are listening to text, which they are then trying to speak simultaneously. And Daniel Fish, to make it a little difficult for them, is live cueing it, so they don't know in which order things are going to happen, in which order they'll be called upon to speak. And in places, he seems to speed up the text until it's almost unpronounceable, and then slow it down. And that means that they're both succeeding and failing. They're tripping over words. They're tripping over tennis balls, which the stage is littered with. And so even though the text in their ears is pre-recorded, that really gives it a feeling of liveness and of presence and of this, I mean, this, and this is what I loved about David Foster Wallace, you know, when I was reading him in my late teens and my early 20s, which I don't think there's any time in one's life when you are more passionately attached to literary figures. What I loved was the sneaky kind of humanity that would work its way in amid the kind of towering erudite and recursive prose. And so while they're speaking this beautifully articulated text, they are also themselves, and they are succeeding in some ways and they are failing in others. They are screwing up lines and they are tripping over their feet and they are giving it all their humanity. Of course, one of the performers in it is Jenny C. Stone Stern, who I think we can all agree is
Jenny C. Stone.
Now Jenny C. Stone,
terrific
in
everything.
Yeah.
So it's,
who else is in that? Mary Rasmussen.
Mary Rasmussen is in it, and
the other two are
two
new
actors
to me.
With
two.
Whom I'm less familiar. And they are terrific. And
she's also performing Jenny C. Stone in
Grimly Handsome,
which, if you missed a few years ago,
you
I'll
have
be seeing
to see
that.
It.
And you know, that's a new thing that is happening at the festival this year, that plays are coming back just for the festival, you know, at independent theaters. So Roosevelt, this is part of COIL, but Waka Waka is bringing back their Baby Universe puppet show. Julia Jarko's Minor Theater is bringing back Grimly Handsome. So it's sort of, you know, this David Foster Wallace, so it's sort of like, if you missed it, here's another chance. But that was the most delightful thing I've seen. Everything else has been a little bit disappointing in one way or another. It's okay. You have good nights. You have bad nights. I saw Temporary Distortion 6-hour installation. I saw about 1:45 of it. My voice has an echo in it. I saw a very short show, on the other hand, a 15-minute show, The Triumph of Fame,
I haven't seen
that. Which one is that one?
That's the one-on-one performance. It's like a very slow and very creepy striptease. Well, let me rephrase that. It is a very slow and very creepy striptease as you are in the room
with her,
with an increasingly naked actress.
And which festival is this a part of?
This is part of UTI.
I just feel that those of us who have been in yoga classes and stripped afterwards, that maybe the excitement is already gone, or no?
Yeah, you know, there was a piece some years ago at PS122 called The Courtesan Tales that I thought was more kind of interesting and full on in its erotic potential, whereas this was this sort of like, oh, look but don't touch, which I'm familiar with. And, you know, there's something, you know, that feels intentionally a little prostitute-y about it. And, you know, I was sitting there and I was wondering how I would feel if I were in a room with a male actor. And I think that would have been a different experience for me, because there would have been that level of estrangement. I mean, we're accustomed to the idea that women will go into small rooms and take off their clothes for other people. And we're less accustomed, of course, men will do that, but we're less accustomed to that idea. So there would have been more of that feeling of estrangement. But this felt a little familiar and a little exploitative. And of course, she's doing the exploiting herself.
Bless her.
This is one of my times when my third wave feminism just kind of ties itself in knots. Swamps, and I feel really,
I wish,
and I feel really conflicted about it.
The Adrian Truscott show, Asking for It.
Oh, will you describe? Because I missed it.
I saw it recently, and it is terrific.
Yeah.
She really is upending so many expectations and ideas of stereotypes. I mean, she comes out, excuse the phrase, it's balls to the walls, but it feels appropriate in describing this because she comes out in this insane getup, multiple wigs that she then begins to off, and then multiple very tight jean jackets under that are covering very large bosoms that she has amplified for the performance, for the purpose of the performance. And then her entire bottom half is nude. And so her pubic hair essentially becomes a goatee because her torso provides projections of male singers,
great,
rappers, comedians. And so her pubic hair becomes both a microphone and a goatee for speaking projections. But beyond all of this design, the entire show is basically about rape culture and the jokes that come around rape culture. And it's a fascinating, and she's wildly talented.
This was about intimacy and distance, performed by a very beautiful woman who's beautiful in a very sort of normative fashion and whose pubic hair was perfectly groomed, which seemed somehow significant.
I wasn't saying anything against Adrian Truscott's pubic
no,
hair.
No, no, no. I just...
but it's also very nice pubic hair.
Let the record show.
That's what I mean is I think it was supposed to feel dangerous and it felt very safe because it felt very familiar.
Processed,
because
yeah,
what
groomed,
with the pornification of the world we're very used to. Beautiful nude female bodies. And so...
Speaking of beautiful nude bodies, if I can just turn the bright light of objectification on the brilliant Andrew Schneider, who is performing You Are Nowhere down at
Invisible Dog.
And he is doing it without a shirt on. Run, don't walk. He is...
Wait, can you pull up a picture of Andrew Schneider on your computer?
Yeah.
I need to know if I
No,
run.
No, I would never do such a thing. It's not my wallpaper.
Yes.
Now, it's... but if we can... If we look at him as a human being and not just as a beautiful object, he is also doing some of the best and is the best at coordinating technology and performance. And technology and video and performance is something with which I have a hate-hate relationship. It is hard for me. I don't usually like it. I usually find that it is not braided deeply into the core of whatever is being made, and so I kind of don't understand why it's there. And this is something in which he is himself someone who is so practiced and so knowledgeable about programming and media, but that the piece, and this is a person who does not make pieces very often, and so it is a beautifully made thing. It is so beautifully made and considered, and it's impossible to describe without ruining some of its surprises. Again, I think a lot of shows we're seeing have these surprises built into them, which makes them very hard to write about as a reviewer. Maybe easier as a like post-show critic, but not as a reviewer. And he does this performance, this one-man performance, which is interacting with programs that he's written so that he seems to be giving you some kind of talk where every time he spasms, the lights change vividly, the sound changes, his voice changes. Things seem to be happening that shouldn't be possible, like his face will be in shadow, but his body will be bright, even though you know where all the lights in the room are. He anticipates things that are happening. Everything is time shifted. So, he has made this room in which, real magic actually seems to be happening. And ladies at home, he's doing it without a shirt on. I'm just saying that Turnabout is finally fair play.
And gentlemen at home. It's a theater.
And it's true. It's true. But he really is. I think
humans at home.
Andrew Schneider is one of those people who I've had a Google alert out for Adrian Truscott because I want to see that show, and I'm furious that I missed it. And he is somebody who you would see him and do something in Catch, and you'd think, well, where's the actual show? I'm so ready for it, and here it is.
And he presented
Don't miss it.
Like years ago. So
yes,
this has long been sort of
this is exactly
marinated.
Exactly this, and you know the old term for, like, what a masterpiece originally meant was the thing that you make to show you're a master, right? The thing that helps you like graduate from being an apprentice or a journeyman to being a master. And I kind of feel like this is in that sense, it's a masterpiece. It's beautiful.
And, you know, so just to rain on that particular parade, I saw My Voice Has an Echo in It, which to me was a very problematic show in terms of the interaction of live performance and video. It was a live show that to me did not feel at all live, that it had been teched out of any kind of liveness, which was kind of extraordinary as it was a durational performance, and nothing feels more live than actors suffering, you know, and it's true. Actors like
who, 2 out of the 4 people around this table just put their head in their hands just so the listeners at home know that.
Actors who seem who we can tell that what they're doing, like it sounds in the Faye Driscoll piece, that what they're doing is sort of awkward or uncomfortable or physically taxing in some way, that feels live. For better or for worse. And
tell me where this is happening.
This is happening at Ideal Glass Factory on 2nd Street. And they built a box in the middle of it. And all of Kenneth Collins' previous temporary distortion shows have used boxes as well as video. Now, this is a bigger box.
it's almost like a trailer.
It's 24 by 6.
It's like a shipping container.
It's basically... it's sort of like the recording studio of the damned. It's this kind of creepy recording studio that is made with one-way, two-way mirrors, so you can see in, but all they see are mirrors, and so you can look in on two sides of it, and they're trapped there. Every so often, they come out to walk around, you know, or
they're allowed to go to the bathroom.
They take breaks.
And there's some
This is not
water.
A piece directed by Daniel Fish,
they don't take breaks, because there's always something going on.
Right.
But sometimes they solo, so the other three can take breaks, but they're basically making music together for 6 hours while there is ambient sound design happening around you, while there is video happening, and none of it feels particularly live. You can see them, but again, they can't see you. So anything you do, and it's not that I want to participate in the piece. I have plenty of pieces where I'm happy to sit back in my not so comfortable chair and just let them do their work. But this just felt, I think, solipsistic.
But see, that's interesting. I saw a version of it when I was in France.
Oh.
So perhaps it was just being in the wonderful Parisian nightlife that excited me or titillated me about the piece. But when I saw the piece, it was in a museum in the outskirts of Paris. And so you had to walk through this incredible exhibit and there was thumping music happening elsewhere in the museum. But once I finally arrived at this similar box, it was a similar setup. There was a different actor in it, I know. But for me, it wasn't so much the liveness that or lack of liveness as the case may have been for you, but it was a kind of hypnotic world. There was something that kind of mesmerized as these long dirges sort of I don't know, the sound and the...
The music was pretty terrific.
Yeah, it just sort of like, it captivated and hypnotized me, so I wasn't so...
Maybe it was the surroundings, because I have to say I was in a dark room that was lit not only by the box, but by a dozen people all checking their phones. Like, there were as many people milling around checking their phones as they were.
Oh, see, that's just awful.
So part of it may have been the environment, but I was surrounded by checked out people.
I would say that if you're going to go and see it, and I saw it, and I saw... I stayed for 45 minutes. I didn't stay for an hour 45. Partially because, you know, in the festival environment, the gotta see a show right now kind of vibe is always there. Go early so that you get the people who aren't checking their phones, the people who show up at 6, or go late when it turns into a party. I think the middle zone may be dangerous.
I left and came back. And when I came back in the middle, there were more people checking their phones. So I started early and then came back. But, you know, the most intense or passionate interaction I had was when the man who had created the mural outside the theater, sort of like dragged me outside to talk about how he had made the mural for 18 hours in the freezing cold.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Well, Helen, you were about to say something.
No, I think I was just breathing deeply.
Oh, that's good. One has to do that in festival season when you mention this sort of gotta go attitude. And I know I don't want to take up too much of your time, but just to, I guess, I wrap things up a teensy bit. It's interesting, I guess, the idea of like festival culture and festival art. Do you feel as though there is such a thing as quote-unquote festival art or things that are appropriate for festivals but maybe less appropriate for regular non-festival times of year? And do you think that that the sheer amount of festivals happening right now is a good thing? I guess I'm interested in hearing something titled In Defense of Festivals.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, do we feel like we have to defend the festivals? What is the worth of these festivals, I guess?
Is more challenging and exciting and experimental performance clustered in these couple of weeks than in the whole rest of the year combined, I think. And even though I've had a somewhat disappointing run this year, I'm expecting that to change any moment. I am so excited. Like, I really,
you still have things coming up on your
I really get that flutter in my heart when I get that first UTR mm-hmm. and that first coil release. I am so excited. I think it'll be a couple of years before we know if some of these other smaller festivals, like Squirts, like Special Effects, are going to stick around and are going to be programming really fascinating stuff. I think it takes at least 3 or 4 years for you to really get the sense.
For sure.
Of what
and
a new festival
like
is going
forces
to be.
Festival from,
I miss Other Forces.
I miss it.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. Other Forces. Also, but I think even Other Forces like took a couple of years before you were like, oh, this is Other Forces, you know, where it really did seem to finally like concatenate.
Other Forces, I should just mention, was with the late but great Incubator.
So I am so excited about this time of year. And I have to say that unlike the Fringe, which I have increasingly come to dread, I don't feel festival fatigue. Mm-hmm. You know, I do live on a bunch of like, you know, there's a lot of dollar pizza that happens, you know, or like bread a manger, half sandwiches. Like there's not a lot of time to like, you know, eat or think or any of the rest of it. But I am so excited to have all these artists working. And I'm also excited that, because the schedules are so varied, artists are seeing other artists, local artists are seeing international artists and vice versa. So there's a lot that's happening virally. I think it's really a moment. I was passing through the lobby during the opening night party at Under the Radar trying to escape it because I always feel weird about like if I take a drink, I'm compromising myself in some way. So I try not to do the parties. But it was so exciting to see all these people in that space. You know, you saw international artists, and there were a bunch of people from, like, Elevator Repair Service, and Mark Russell was somewhere, and Kristen Marting from here in the Prototype Festival was somewhere. And, it just felt like all of these super downtown bold-faced names were all coming together in this moment. And I love that. As far as festival art, I would say that as long as it's good, and I realize that good is an ambiguous term, I would just say, like, the weirder the better, the more surprising the better. Like, what I want out of a festival is something I haven't seen before. There's plenty of space in the year for a conventional drama, and I like those too, but I don't really want to see one.
Not
at a festival.
January.
I don't want to see a play. In January. I mean, I'm seeing plays because now Broadway is happening too. So I had to take a break from the festival to see Honeymoon in Vegas.
Yeah.
Which did not
maybe,
seem like
maybe
a good
if you
trade.
Think of Honeymoon in Vegas as unbelievably anhedonic post-avant-garde material, you'll enjoy it.
Maybe.
Durational Broadway.
Maybe. Maybe.
Rancière's next book.
Oh.
Get on it, Jean-Paul. Now, I think, one of the great things written about the APAP is the reason why all this is happening, because there are so many presenters and producers in town that everybody's
Association of Performing Arts Presenters, they have their annual convention in
so
January.
So this is everybody's chance to kind of get picked up, I guess, and
tour
and sell their wares. is there was a very angry, wonderful piece written by Claudia Larocco last year called A Pap Smear, and it is
which she stole from Vallejo Gantner. That was
That
was his hashtag.
I think A Pap Smear is pretty much common lexicon.
Well, she
hasn't been making
it's like the calculus.
I'm just saying she hot tipped him, and that was where I first saw it. Was his hashtag to describe the festival?
Sure.
But that was a fantastic piece.
What did she say in that piece?
She was lamenting a little bit the kind of high school vibe. She was also lamenting the fact that people now make work with an eye to getting it picked up. And so that it's almost not important what we think a festival piece is, but what the artists think a festival piece is. So is there something that the artists think is saleable, and are they starting to make their work towards that idea? And I don't know. I you know, purely selfishly, it's the best time of year. It is so fun. It's the only, and this is, okay, so I think a lot of people who moved to New York who are not New Yorkers sometimes feel this way, which is that we just missed it. Like, oh, wow, if only I'd been here 10 years earlier when House of Candles was really going. Ugh, if only I'd been here 15 years earlier when Reza Abdo was here. Ugh, if only I'd been here. And this is the one time where I actually feel like I was standing in that Temporary Distortion show, and I also had sort of mixed feelings about it, but I remember standing there and thinking, this is the New York I was promised. I was promised a welter of good and bad, of shows that were talking to each other and about each other sometimes. I was promised that I would get to go to the Wild Project and watch a woman urinate on herself as a performance piece, and that I would think that it was ridiculous. Like, the whole, everything good and bad in this season is sort of, this is the one time I really feel like I'm in my idea of what I wanted New York to be.
I think if you love experimental theater, if you love experimental performance, this is your 12 days
Catnip,
of Christmas.
Baby. This is Christmas. Eliza, that, is it your Christmas?
On that highly problematic note, no. As a secular something, I don't know.
Yes.
That's great. That's super.
It's your 12 days of Hanukkah.
It's the 12
Doesn't
days.
Hanukkah have
it's the
12
Festivus
days?
For the rest of us, or for only some of us that like experimental theater. But it is. It's an interesting thing. It's high schoolish, but it's also if you're a part of it, then you actually feel like you're a part of some community. And as scary as it can be to navigate those parties and soirees, it's also extremely thrilling. So. And there's also art happening beyond the parties. You know, there's great, there's the great art. So the 12 days of Christmas, the 12 days of Festivus and theatricalness and festivalness. On that, once again, problematic note. I see
how is that problematic? That is great. That is great.
Not as articulate as you two, but
it's our pagan solstice performance festival. I mean, we can all get behind
that. That's right.
That,
and
right?
Unfortunately,
well,
we'll just burn
our
one
place
person.
Of worship.
That's
yeah,
true.
Then,
right.
Then it does sort of feel appropriate
right.
to be making.
All hail.
Welcome back. I'm here again with Eliza and Deep.
Hello.
This is Rob. And we're going to do our recommendations, things we think you should know about that we've known about. So Deep, why don't you start off?
Sure. So part of my, I'm seeing six shows this week for the festivals.
That's a lot.
It's my excuse to see three shows in one day, which I would not do it any other time during the year. And I started off my festival season by seeing Roselvis from Team this past Saturday.
What'd you think?
Oh, it was fantastic. I have such a girl crush on Christian C now.
They're both of those performers.
Oh, both of them are
incredible.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. But the team that is collective in Brooklyn, and they focus on theater that with like American themes or iconic figures or like things that like are really they explore American identity and what it means to be living as an American now. And so their work Roselvis is this kind of fantasy meeting between Theodore Roosevelt and Elvis Presley, and where Elvis Presley and Theodore Roosevelt are played by two women, Libby King and Kristen C, who are part of the company. And it's also an examination of, you know, LGBTQ identity and also middle America. And it's like this fantastical journey. And it was funny. And Cherry Jones was in the audience, the the day I saw it. And that made her so much cooler in my book because of that. Nothing against Sherry Jones, but...
She's talking about taking that show to Broadway with her as Teddy.
Yes.
No, just kidding.
That would be amazing.
That wouldn't be?
Although, I gotta say, Libby King is of convincing Elvis.
Yes. Yeah, she has that.
She's got the name, so... Yeah. But she also, I mean, like, actually, her look is so close.
Oh, I've seen the pictures. Yeah, I haven't seen the show. Yeah.
The two of them are just so spot on with their...
The intonation and how... Just, like, they channeled the way these two men spoke. It was fantastic. But you can't see it now because it's done running. But they're going to publish... O'Brien Books is going to publish an anthology of five of the team's plays, and Rose Elvis is... among them, so...
Mission Drift is another?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, which is a... Mission Drift was about Las Vegas and capitalism.
Yeah, and they've now... Yeah. I think they've just celebrated 10 years.
Yes.
So congratulations to the team.
Go team.
For existing 10 years. They're a great... Yeah, great company.
So my recommendation would be when the book comes out, pick it up and read Rose Elvis and put it up in your theater because it's a fantastic two-hander piece.
Wow. So it's Rose Elvis, not Ruse Elvis?
Rosa Velvis.
Technically, it's spelled Rosa Velvis, but everyone pronounces it Rose Elvis.
Okay.
No. I have always heard it as Rosa Velvis.
No, Rachel Chafkin, who directed Rose Elvis, she came out and announced the show, and she pronounced it Rose Elvis.
That's funny.
Well, I have some conversation with Rachel then ahead of me. I really?
Yeah.
Maybe they changed. I remember I wrote about it when it was first done at the Bushwick Star, and I sat in on a rehearsal, and I feel like, well, who knows? Maybe I know that they trimmed some stuff from it for this mm-hmm.
Maybe they
current
trimmed
iteration.
Two letters.
So perhaps they trimmed two letters from the title, too. I don't know.
It's silent. You know, it's American English. Very, very, very weird sometimes.
Right, sure.
So.
And Eliza,
Rob, what about you?
Me? You want to go to me next for recommendations? I'm going to recommend... reading the script of Into the Woods, and not just because TCG publishes it, but because
I wish.
Well, we do publish it. It's not a wish.
It's not a conflict of interest at all. Okay.
It's not a conflict. No, I was actually asked to review the movie by the Sondheim Review. I occasionally write reviews for the Sondheim Review, which is cool. And I was planning to see the movie anyway. I'm not a big fan of the movie. I know it has its partisans. I think it's great that the movie's out there in the world. And I hope it directs people back to the original. But I would say reading the script was pretty revelatory, especially because I realized just – and I knew this intuitively – how it's almost through composed. It's almost all music. And reading it, there are no song breaks. It doesn't tell you in the script, at least the way it's published, when a song starts, when it ends. And it feels like one piece of composition and writing. And – the movie, you know, does its best trying to turn it into a film, but there's just no cinematic equivalent that at least Rob Marshall hasn't cracked it for that kind of just beginning to end composition that piece is. And I would just recommend, especially if you've seen the movie, go back and compare it. If you're not already an Into the Woods, you know, aficionado, it really was a worthwhile thing. And I can't get the whole score out of my head, but that's not a bad thing.
That's usually what happens when you watch a Sondheim musical, though.
Sure. There's a lot of themes come up. And, of course, there is an Into the Woods that's just opened off Broadway, the Fiasco Theaters.
Yes, at Roundabout.
Oh, did they do that before? Is this again?
They did do it. They did it at the McCarter, and it was La Jolla?
No, Old Globe.
One of those
and Sandy now areas. It's they're remounting it in New York City. But it was so funny. I was watching the Globes last night because that is what I do sometimes in my spare time, watch award shows and watch and critique people in pretty dresses.
Okay.
And when Kate Hudson, she introduced Into the Woods, and she says, Rob Marshall's vision of combining Cinderella and Little Red Riding Hood and Jack and the Beanstalk into this dark fairy tale. And I was just sitting there screaming, no, it was James Lapine and Stephen Sondheim. Rob Marshall did nothing except, you know, film it. But
right. I mean, I feel like the misconception is understandable because it does feel like Rob Marshall's vision more than Sondheim and Lapine's in the movie, but it wasn't his idea. And it's
well, but James Lapine did like the musical staging during the movie, like when they.
Well, he did the screenplay more to the point, and I think it's actually a pretty good screenplay for what it is. We can go into that. This is not a movie review show. I do say that it's mixed experience. The movie, if you're a fan of the show, but then that's.
Have you seen the movie?
Oh, yes.
I have not seen the movie yet.
Are you going to see the movie?
I would like to. I was the baker's wife in high school.
Oh, my God. Really?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so I had never... It's the only Stephen Sondheim show that I'm familiar with.
That's true of a lot of people. And Company. Yeah, Company.
I know Company. Yes. I watched the movie of Company a year ago.
You mean the DVD of the Neil Patrick Harris?
Being Alive.
Yes.
It's amazing.
It's amazing you saw that and still wanted to get married.
Oh, my God. Of course.
I had the song.
You know what he says about being alive? It starts off as a lament, but it becomes a prayer.
I think I've said it on this podcast before. That was played at my wedding, that song. So.
No, I didn't know that.
Alive?
Yeah. High five. You
Robin
too?
Robin and Liza just high five.
Are you serious?
Pippa Sue sang Being Alive at my wedding.
Oh, my God.
Can you believe it?
What
oh, my
a small
gosh.
She's that's amazing. I had a singer named Kevin
Isn't
Ray.
Isn't Hamilton?
She's going to be in Hamilton, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's...
She sang that song. Who sang it at your wedding?
A guy named Kevin Ray, who's a musical singer-songwriter.
What?
He's not
you
a star.
Get those
star.
Two together to sing
a duet version.
Being
right.
Alive.
Wait. So why did?
Wait.
Why?
God,
why?
How did we not know this?
I don't.
This
we didn't. We didn't compare notes on our wedding plans.
Holy smokes!
Why that song though? Was it?
Well, listen to the words,
it's
man. It's
incredible.
All about
incredible.
Yeah,
the song is so epic.
No, I love that song, but because you're not a musical theater person, Eliza.
Certainly not. No.
Who'd she marry, though? Huh?
Well, I do love people that love musical theater.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
I that's not true. I like musical theater a lot. I don't know it very well in the way that many people who love musical theater seem to like know it well and have soundtracks and can recite things, but. There's odd pockets of my brain that are familiar. Because in high school, I was in Cabaret, and I was in Into the Woods.
This is very
and
revealing.
And I was in
I know
the
so much
Fantastics.
I know so much about you now. Oh, my gosh.
I know. Well, it's a surprising thing. But, you know, you come to theater in funny ways. But I didn't, you know, what did I know? I just liked being in plays. And so, and you know, I'm not a singer, but I can carry a tune. So I think these are sort of favored... You know, my spunk or my trying. They put right. me in the Fantastics. They had rewritten a role so that I was the mom instead of the two dads. It was
oh wow,
a mom and a dad. So
for Into the Woods,
wild.
Wow. For Into the Woods, was your prince hot when he seduced you?
Oh, that's actually an unfortunate story. I remember talking to the director of the wonderful Christian Polos, who ran the dance and performing arts department at my high school, and remember. Taking Mr. Polis aside and saying, Mr. Polis, I really don't think that in our version that the baker's wife needs to kiss the prince. It's horrible. I don't even remember his name, but he didn't have a very good odor, and I just thought, maybe we should avoid this because I don't want there to be a kiss if we're not going to believe it. I was, you know, really committed to the
theatrical reality.
But my friend played the baker, who I'm still friends with and is a rock and roll musician, among
wow.
other things. And, so that was very fun to get to be married to him, but Todd Goldstein.
Wow.
But we didn't have to kiss because I guess I don't know the baker
so
and his wife don't ever kiss.
If I drop quotes from the baker's wife's lines, you'll like
Rob,
get them.
That's
you'll
why
get
I
them.
Said when you said like I recommend.
I wish.
And
yeah,
I said,
I know.
I wish.
I know.
Anywho. That's like I stole the thunder from your recommendation.
No, not at all. It wasn't much of one, but that's...
Deep, I think this means that you now have to have Being Alive...
Stuck in my head for the rest of the
no.
day.
No, sung at your wedding.
If you are ever married, that is where you should be sung at your wedding. Just the words are
just
incredible.
Just think about it, you know.
If I'll tell Susie, our managing editor, too, so all of us can have
we
Being
can
Alive...
We can all have Being Alive as
sung at our wedding.
Anthem.
I mean, I have sung it alone in my room, but I think that's... Everything. That's everyone who loves Company.
So good.
Because alone is alone, not alive. Anyway, so what's your... What's
see,
your,
I, see? No. I resent that as a single person.
I'm just saying.
Someone to tell me something. I don't know what
yes.
it is. It's so good.
Yes, to pull me up short, put me through hell. It's a wonderful lifting song.
Someone to sit in my chair
and ruin my sleep and make me aware.
Oh.
Yes. All right. So, do you have a recommendation or?
Okay, I got very concerned about the recommendation portion of this podcast, and so I have four, but I'll be very quick about them.
Go for it.
I promise. Adrian Truscott's Asking for It is a one lady rape about comedy starring her pussy and little else. I saw it recently. She's a performer with so much balls and pizzazz. Pizzazz may be the wrong word, but it's incredible. It's really genre bending and
that description is
stand-up comedy. I was reading the description from the
A one woman rape about comedy.
Yeah, and she has all of these images of male comedians that are known for their rape jokes or whatever on stage with her, and I thought that this was a really interesting program note that she had. Two facts. Where was I reading this? Basically, she talks about how when she says, the first time I cracked a joke about this topic, i.e. rape and rape joke culture, was offstage among other women comics while working off the coast of Mexico on a cruise ship with 1,800 lesbians on vacation. Two facts about that trip collided unexpectedly. It was an incredibly safe space as a woman and an unpredictably conservative and treacherous space for a comedian. And I thought that that was such an interesting sort of collision as a background for this really incredible and bizarre, terrifying, amazing show about
wow. comedy. And that's playing as part of the festivals? Or
this is in that festival special effects. And
okay.
I believe it's it's already toured, so I imagine it will
okay.
continue to tour. I also have been a big fan of Black Mirror recently.
Oh, the show?
I've
heard it's amazing. Yeah.
Show, an anthology show. It's sort of very dystopian. Each episode is a completely new world unto itself. It's very terrifying and amazing. I've also been reading a book, and I like that book a lot.
Yeah.
It's called The Interestings.
It sounds interesting.
It is interesting. Reading can be interesting.
Who's that by? Just real.
Meg Wolitzer.
Okay. Yeah, I know that name.
And then the last thing, with all of this nutty terrorism stuff and reaction stuff going on, I read a very interesting piece by Hari Kunzru in The Guardian about all of the France business, you know, that was just an interesting take on what this world is, what's going on in our world.
Bad time. Ending on that cheerful note, go see a show, whether it's a festival show or otherwise.
Well, there's other festivals going on.
Yeah, we were going to mention New York is not the only place where there are festivals. January is also festival month in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, where Tricklock's Revolutions Festival is going through February 1st, and in Portland, Oregon, where Fertile Ground, its New Works Festival, also goes through February 1st. So check those out. I think we're going to have some coverage online about those.
So many good festivals.
Yeah, so many good people experimenting with form.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
And then the Push Festival in Vancouver, that happens soon.
It's very festive.
And are you depressed because it's January? Like, why January?
It's off season in a way.
It's a good time because it's sort of like you're not distracted by going. You're not distracted by going to the beach.
You're definitely not going to the beach. I also think it's getting out of the gate before other stuff opens. It's sort of a downish time for some theaters, although they're starting up again.
Yeah, it's like a respite because in between Christmas and spring, there's really nothing to look forward to. And so it's like January is like that burst of adrenaline usually for me.
It's a nice time to catch up with people that you haven't seen because you missed them during December, which is always a crazy one.
I agree with all that. Another award-winning episode. Thanks for listening. And we'll talk to you next time.
Ciao for now.